The boat got caught in the current and Don managed to escape. He had to walk back about 4 kilometres where the hut is just to get another boat to drive across the inlet to then drive an hour and a quarter back to Manjimup.
Our grandparents and parents is something that all of us at some stage are going to have to face. And most of us don't like thinking about it. So don't worry, we won't make you think too hard about it today. What we are talking about is that comforting thought that a little piece of the people we lose will always stick with us. Perhaps in an object or a memory or just a deep feeling that in some sense they are still here. Like fingerprints. Unseen by the naked eye, leaving a hidden mark on everything and everyone they have touched. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and this week we have three stories about life after loss and the shared experience of it that ties us all together. When Josh Garlop was living in a share house in Perth, his housemate Brock would play guitar a lot. Brock is from Manjimup in southwest WA. He's a mechanic and a music lover. One day, when Brock was playing a tune at home, Josh noticed something roughly scratched into Brock's guitar. The word whacker. When Josh asked him about it, the answer was quite the story. This piece is about Brock's family and a secret place only they know about. A hidden inlet far from the main road, 5 hours south of Perth. It was always a special place to them, before a family tragedy.
My family's been going down to a spot called Broken Inlet. It's about an hour and a quarter from Manjimup. Yeah, my family's been going down there since 1932. So the area that we've got our hut is on, I guess, like a small headland that overlooks the entirety of the inlet. It's hard thing to describe this place. Telling people everything about it means nothing as soon as you see it. Yeah, and it's just a beautiful vista of huge rolling hills, wonderful water, lovely peppermint trees. There's a couple of freshwater rivers that flow through. They lock their land access off. Absolutely, completely inaccessible by land. It's a very profound place. Wonderful. My grandfather, Whacker, because that was his nickname, I thought his name was Whacker up until the age of about 15 or 16. Went down and started doing some professional fishing when he was a young man in the inlet. The existing cannery that was there eventually turned into a ramshackle hut. So unfortunately, and fortunately, we've had to erect a new dwelling. Over the last 3 years, we have boated everything over, captained by my father, Wayne Crombie Wilson, who's a nutcase. What makes the inlet so special to obviously myself, but to my family as well? Obviously the longevity of our stay there, but also the fact that, I guess, the captain of the crew, so to speak, Ross Wilson, Whacker, my granddad, he was killed there. Eight years ago, him and his brother Don were just going for a bit of a putt up to where the inlet meets the ocean. There's a big sandbar there. As they were puttering up, you know, the two very old men, my grandfather was 82 at the time and Don was 75. They didn't quite realise how much water had built up in the inlet over the winter. So when they'd arrived at this sandbar that divides the inlet from the ocean, they were about 11 or 12 foot above sea level, so they couldn't actually see where the end of the inlet was. inadvertently they got caught in a current that was pulling all the inlet water out into the ocean because it had broken the sandbar. My grandfather was steering, managed to hit the sandbar and wedge the boat in enough for Don to jump out of the boat. Two hip replacements and a stuffed knee and this and that didn't quite allow him to make it out of the boat. So he was swept out to the open ocean through the inlet. There were air rescue teams, surf rescue came down from Windy Harbour and Walpole and the surrounds. There's big search parties, but no, the body was never recovered. On the day that Wacker disappeared, it was just Don and himself down there. When the boat got caught in the current and Don managed to escape, he had to walk back about 4 kilometres where the hut is, the dwelling that we have there, just to get another boat to drive across the inlet, to then drive an hour and a quarter back to Manjimup to tell somebody what had happened because he doesn't have a phone and the rest. And it was quite a concerning day, obviously. It was, you know, pretty heavy stuff going on. He had managed to pull someone over on the way back to Manjimup to get their phone to, you know, call emergency services. So by that stage, we'd heard about it as well. And I'd jumped in my car because the emotion was getting a bit extreme for me, so I had to leave. And as I was driving down the road, Don was driving back from the accident in Grandad's car, and he looks very similar to my granddad. So I'd immediately assumed that it was Grandad and freaked out. Then I chased the car down, found out that it was Don, and then, yeah, had a big talk to Don about what had happened. And so, but he was a mess. He was, you know, a broken man. He'd just lost his brother in extreme emotional distress, still wet clothing. And Don is one of the founding members of the Australian SAS. So, yeah, as much as emotion and fear and the rest were taking hold, I guess he managed to use the tools of his mind to get him through that one day. The emotional distress that was upon everybody was also upon me. And when I'd heard the news, I was playing guitar. I guess I'd scratched Wacker, W-A-K-A, into my guitar just to keep him around, I guess, because he'd gone. Everyone knew that he was gone. There was never any finding him. Like, we could have found the body, but he wouldn't have been alive. We held two memorial services for Wack. One was held at the Manjimup Motorcycle Club that he was a life member of. For a small town, it was massive. There was 500 people there, which is a pretty big bloody deal. The second memorial we held down at the coast, at the hut, and we pretty much gutted the hut and pulled out all of his possessions, everything that he owned, and had a big funeral pyre there, so just burnt everything. Extremely somber, but as soon as the ice was broken with, it was one of the greatest nights you could ever attend, really. Frivolity and friendship and the rest, it's just great. We had a bad time, but we managed to make good of it. The best way to sum my granddad up is my father was talking to him one day, and he said to Ross, my granddad, "Mate, what do you want people to say when you're dead? Like, how do you want to be remembered, Wacker?" And Ross turned around and he said, "Oh, look, at the end of the day, I just want people to think of me as a pretty good bloke." And I find that really touching, really endearing. He doesn't want to be the best bloke, and he certainly doesn't want to be the worst bloke, but a pretty good bloke. And that was enough for Wacker. Incredibly intelligent man, a massive overachiever. He just liked people to think of him as a pretty cool, decent guy. And that's really nice. Every time we go down to the coast, we've got a little headstone there up on top of the limestone embankment that I was talking about. So he's got a great view. We just go up there and have a port with him and pour some out for King Neptune and have one for us. And he'd love a beer. Loved a beer.
That story was by Josh Garlop, with special thanks to Brock Crombie-Wilson and Wacker. This week we're talking about traces of family members left behind after they're gone in objects, memories, or their ghosts. Our next piece comes from Yellamundi, the National First Peoples Playwriting Festival. It's from a play called A Little Bit of Ash by Megan Wilding. Let me set the scene a bit for you here. Jed is sitting on a bench outside her uni, smoking a cigarette. She seems fidgety and distressed. She's just recovered from a panic attack. Her mum just died. In this scene, Jedda's mum's spirit stands to the side of stage. She interjects from time to time, so that's the older voice that you can hear. Meanwhile, Jedda's friend Mendy is trying to comfort her. Just a heads up, there's strong language in this story.
Jedda puffs on a cigarette. A piece of ash falls from it, burning her.
Fuck! Language!
She drops the cigarette to the ground, stamps it out and kicks it away. Without thinking, she starts to roll another one. Mendy, a young woman around Jedda's age, tentatively stands out of sight. She watches Jedda light the cigarette. She has her phone in her left hand. She quickly reads something on the phone, quietly mouths, "How are you?" to herself, practicing. She's been standing there for too long now. She's trying to decide whether to exit and enter again, go over and hug Jedda, or just leave. Panic.
I know you're back there doing something weird behind me, Mendy.
No, I wasn't.
Just come sit down, dickhead.
Mendy sits. She watches Jedda smoke a cigarette. They're both unsure of what to say. Mendy reaches into her duffel bag.
I got you a Coke.
Thanks.
Something about a fizzy drink that always makes me feel better.
It's probably the sugar.
Yeah. Hey, can I have a sip?
Go for it.
So, how are you feeling?
Fine.
Jedda, you don't have to pretend.
I'm not. I'm fine.
Open mouth, insert foot, Mendy.
You can just talk to me like normal, yeah?
Yeah, I know. It's just, I genuinely don't know what the fuck to say. Like, what's the protocol for sorry business?
I don't know.
I stood in the cafe for 20 minutes trying to decide what beverage I should get you.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was standing there looking like a stunned mullet, wondering what beverage was appropriate to buy. First, thought about getting you a tea. Tea is nice and comforting. Can't go wrong with Twinings.
I prefer bushels myself.
Then, until I started thinking about how fucking depressing it was, just thinking of this bag of leaves and water just floating there and slowly turning everything dark. And, you know, old people drink it a lot. About people dying, because that would just make a bad situation worse, so that was an obvious no. Then I thought, maybe I should just get her a bottle of water. A nice, cold bottle of water. Great idea, Mendy! So I walk up to the counter and ask for a bottle of water, and guess what?
What?
The fucking thing is warm, because they just restocked the water. And I wasn't going to buy you warm water. It would be like drinking from a tap. Like, that's idiotic. I'm not feral, Jedda.
It's not that bad.
So that's when I started thinking about those watermelon apple ginger juices. They're so fresh. But remember that time they got a bad batch of oranges and literally everyone got sick? Thank you, but no thank you. Also, they're $9.50 and I only have $7 in my account.
Ah, the truth comes out.
But then I had this moment of genius. Coke, to make you feel better. Jedda.
That sounds like an ad.
Huh?
You know, one of those ones that you end up crying over even though it's for something that isn't emotional at all, like nappies or gum.
Or going home for Christmas to see your mum had me sobbing.
Oh, that's awkward.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hey, it's nothing. Gotcha.
Thanks. Hey, sorry about before. Bit of an overreaction. Now I am alone. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. And then boom, hysterical lady crying like it's the end of the world.
I think we might remember it differently.
I was a mess.
You weren't.
I was trash.
Jedda. You answered your phone, started hyperventilating, went really still, and then you just walked out of the room like nothing happened.
God, what a drama queen.
Your mum just died.
I'm not gone, though.
Yeah, I sound like a weirdo.
Stop being defensive.
I'm not.
You are.
Whatever.
Do you want to talk about it?
No.
Jedda, you can't ignore this. We should talk about it. You need to talk about it.
I don't want to.
Why?
Because I just found out about a frickin' hour ago.
Has it been that long?
I don't think I can.
You should try, Jedda.
I don't want to cry.
That's stupid. Jedda, you can't just shut down.
I haven't. I'm not
shutting. You haven't moved for 40 minutes. Don't you think there's a reason for that?
Like what?
Like, maybe. I don't know. You're in shock.
Shock?
Yeah, you're in shock. Your brain is trying to convince itself that everything's normal.
Is that what this is?
Talk to me. How are you?
I don't want to talk about it, Mendy.
Jed, it's natural to cry in a situation like this. Just talk to me.
Okay, Dr. Phil. Talk, 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 talk.
Okay,
talk.
Stop.
What? Don't you like my Dr. Phil? It's my new party trick.
God, would you stop making jokes? This isn't funny. Talk to me, Jed. Tell me how you're feeling. It's what you should be doing. It says you should.
Wait, what says I should?
The internet. This article that I read, it says the first step in dealing with grief is denial and that you should talk about it. It's not just going to go away by ignoring it.
What article was it?
I can link it to you. It might help if you read it.
I'm still capable of surfing the World Wide Web. Thanks, though.
There's a quiz you can take which works out what your personality type is and tells you how your particular type deals with loss. Super helpful. With these cartoon characters and fries.
Are you kidding me?
Here, let me read it to you. Denial. That's not possible. I just saw a guy walk out of here with fries. Bargaining. Come on, I'm sure you have one or two left. Let's just say I take what's left and leave, okay?
I wonder if this one's an actress.
Depression. I'll never taste the sweet flavour of fries again. Boo-hoo!
It does not say boo-hoo.
Acceptance. Okay. Can I have a burger then?
Great. Do you think I should go get some burgers? Do you think that'll help?
Jada, that's not the point.
That's what it says in the 5 stages of grief.
You should be talking about how you are feeling now. It will help.
Because it says here on the internet, Miss Web MD.
No, because you have a tendency to just bottle everything up. I'm worried about you. Talk to me. I'm just trying to help you, Jada.
I don't want to be helped right now. I like feeling like shit. I really like it. I'm just thankful I'm able to feel something. I don't care what it is. I think it's great. It's some sort of fucked up sign that I'm not numb, that somewhere in here something still has circulation. I don't need to worry about my toe being cut off because I can still feel my feet. And that's comforting, don't you reckon? I don't want to talk about any of it. I don't want to read any stupid articles about it. It just fucking happened. My mum is dead, gone. She has ceased to exist, that's it. What don't you get? All I want to do right now is sit here and chain smoke and feel like shit. I don't want to do anything else.
Feel good to get off your chest?
Jetta grabs the Coke and pours it on the ground.
I've got no more drink left. Can you go get me another one?
That excerpt was from a play reading at Yellamundi, the National First Peoples Playwriting Festival. Yellamundi works to bring Indigenous voices to Australian theatre, and that story comes from writer Megan Wilding. The reading was performed at Carriageworks in Sydney. If you want to find out more about Yellamundi, head to our website, allthebestradio.com, for more info. You're listening to All the Best. Tanya Ray, who brings us our next story, is in her mid-20s. She's still figuring out what to do with her life, what makes her happy, and what career path to settle on. So basically, she's a pretty normal 24-year-old. For as long as she's known them, Tanya's grandparents have been devoted to the Christian church. Their lives were focused on the church community, people in their parish, and each other. It's not a life Tanya wants for herself per se, but she's always admired her grandparents. So she decided to take a look at their lives and maybe figure out her own life plan along the way.
Throughout my childhood, particularly around Christmas time, I remember seeing hundreds of Christmas cards hung up all around the house. They were in the living room, the dining room, the kitchen. They were from everyone they went to church with. All these people whose lives they touched within the Christian community. Now, I'm not religious myself, and neither is my family really, but we still play a small part for Pa, which is what we call my granddad. Every time we have a big family event together, my Pa will say a prayer before we eat. Everyone listens. It's kind of a small thing we do to show our respect. Nana is no longer with us, and Pa is the last grandparent I have left. Up until their retirement, Nana and Pa had both been quite active religious leaders in their community, and both extremely well-loved. Even as they got older, they kept in touch with their parish, they belonged to senior support groups, and would visit the elderly in nursing homes. But I knew their church roles weren't their whole story. I knew they'd had other lives before. So I decided to talk to my dad's side of the family and try and piece together a more complete picture of their past.
I do remember that my mum was quite talkative and my dad was a lot quieter. I remember many times I felt that they were a little bit over the top with their religious beliefs, as we weren't allowed to listen to music or watch TV because that was considered evil.
This is my dad, Paul. He's one of 5 children and Nana and Pa's second eldest son.
I may not have agreed with all their strict religious beliefs all the time and sometimes wish that I could have had normal parents that let their kids do normal things.
Luckily, Nana and Pa softened up quite a bit over the years. Growing up and visiting them in their home, they never had any issues with me binge-watching Disney movies on the couch. But my Uncle Peter seemed to remember his childhood a little differently. He was born in Western Australia, but Nana and Pa raised him mainly in Mama Creek, a small Queensland town of about 400 people.
It would have been just thinking, I have fond memories of growing up in Queensland, but for Pa it would have been very hard because it was there was no running hot water, so they had to boil hot water on the stove. The toilet was a bush toilet down the backyard, 100 metres down the path, which had to be emptied into a pit every week. And so it was a tough life for Dad, so I sort of admire him for putting up with that as a young man. I guess he would have been in his 20s and 30s.
My granddad's pushing 90 now and isn't very mobile, so initially I wasn't planning on interviewing him. But his voice was the one that I most wanted to hear from. When I was a kid, no one could tell stories quite like Pa. I wanted to know who he was before the church and what his life could have been like if he hadn't turned to God. He lives in a retirement village now, but he managed to get to my auntie's house, which is only a few streets away.
Now you can ask the questions, but whether I can answer them or not is going to be another thing.
Yeah, they're just.
We had a chat and I recorded some of his few remaining memories.
You're going to have difficulty with me in memory now.
When I was a kid, I'd only known them as church leaders. But I'd had no idea Nana and Pa's lives had switched directions so dramatically when they were in their mid-20s, the same age as me. Pa had a childhood dream of becoming a pilot and got his flying licence. It was in the 50s in Sydney.
I just flew tiger moths because it had been my idea in the first place to work as a pilot, but I didn't get that far.
If you didn't know, tiger moths were a 1930s biplane. They're those tiny bright yellow ones with the double wings, two stacked on top of each other. They look kind of like a toy plane. Pa would fly them recreationally before he gave them up for God.
God was doing his work within me, and I was feeling more and more that I wanted to do what he would have me do.
But a piece of that life has always stuck with him. This I discovered through the use of their spare room, which I remember as a child. It was filled with models of toy planes, trains and cars, but mostly they were planes. The watch he wears now has a plane on the second hand, ticking and flying clockwise around its face.
Pa used to take us to the airport on weekends. We would often just drive out to Bankstown Airport and stand at the fence and watch the planes take off and land.
This is my auntie Lois. She was born in Toowoomba in Queensland, but the family moved to Sydney when she was only 6 months old.
He had a friend who still had his pilot's licence who would let him fly occasionally, and he took me up in the plane once with him and his friend for a flight.
My Nana Elva isn't around anymore, but I remember her as a very patient and caring woman, always commenting on all the amazing things we have these days, like phone cameras. They blew her mind. If she were alive today, she would be 88 years old, the same age as Pa. When Nana was just 12 years old, back in the 40s, she sat an IQ test. She got a score of above 170, which back then was the highest score they could measure. At the time, the local paper wrote an article about her. It had a black and white photo of her crouching down in school uniform with pigtails. Now, I know IQ tests aren't perfect, and they've improved since back then. But to put Nana into perspective, Einstein was believed to have an IQ of only 160. She was brilliant. After high school, she went on to study mathematics at the University of Sydney. This would have been phenomenally rare for a woman of her time. She would have been one of the few females in the entire university doing something like this. After graduating, she worked as a biometrician for the CSIRO at just age 22.
She was a very smart lady, yeah. And I think From my perspective, it was I found that good because in high school she was able to help me with my maths, and we had our own personal tutor for maths in particular. And
today there's an award named after Nana at the University of Sydney. It's called the Mrs. Elva Ray Talented Mathematics Student Award. It's awarded to encourage and support talented female students to reach their full potential in mathematics. Bit ironic. Nana's potential to have an extraordinary career was cut short when she met Parr at church. You could say it was because of the times when women gave up careers for marriage, but they were in love. The two were engaged for about 5 years and married as soon as Parr finished Bible college. She never went back to work. It took me a while to completely understand why they gave up on their dreams. These amazing careers that would have taken them so far. They both showed so much talent and promise, but they just turned themselves to God and forgot about their early passions. Was it a mistake?
Oh, I don't think either of them would regret not pursuing their earlier passions. If they did, they probably wouldn't admit it. Dad felt so strongly that God wanted him to preach for him that, like I said, he handed back his pilot's licence and became a minister.
Even if she did, she wouldn't probably tell you anyway. Accepted the role that she had as a mother bringing up the family. I myself sometimes think it seems such a shame that such a brilliant person wasn't able to pursue her career after she got married, given her brilliance.
I'm sure they thought about it every now and again, possibly, but they never, ever, ever displayed that they did not enjoy the life that they had and the life that they were living for God and for family.
I'm turning 25 this year, which would have been almost the same age Nana finished working for the CSIRO and married Pa. It's difficult to imagine being in her shoes and deciding to marry at such a young age and throw away such a promising career, following a husband down the path of God and raising 5 kids. But seeing how long they stayed together and how much love they had for each other, it's really hard to feel like they were missing out on life.
One standout memory that comes to mind is their 50th wedding anniversary.
I remember their 25th wedding anniversary.
Look, I have strong memories of their 50th wedding anniversary, which was not that long ago now, I suppose.
They had many, many friends and relatives attending a big luncheon in a hall. And it's a feat that not many people achieve these days.
Thinking I was lucky to have a mum and dad who loved one another so much and able to survive all the trials and tribulations that they had.
I had to kind of smile to myself when I realised the standout memories all their children had of them were of long-time celebrations of their love and marriage. I realise now that even though they both had so much potential, they found so much more meaning in God, their community and each other. Those Christmas cards in the living room, in the hundreds, they were testament to the lives they lived. They were happy. I really admire them for knowing what they want and going for it, even though to me it seemed like they were giving up so much, especially Nana. Maybe Nana's brilliance shone through her kids and her family, and it was never forgotten, certainly not by Pa, even with his fading memory. What about Nana? What was your favourite thing about Nana?
Well, I loved her. She and I were one. Yes, I just remembered that she was very wonderful. Gloriously wonderful.
That story was by Tanya Ray. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager, and I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.